All right. Yes, we're continuing. We're finishing up our mini-series of Understanding the Faith. And as GP mentioned, first week, Marion, well-created, talked about creation. And she talked about the image of God and what it is to be made in the image of God. She talked about the fact that we are made like him to act and to do like him on earth. We have a responsibility as people made in his image. In his likeness. And it didn't take much for me to enjoy her message, and she's my wife. She's great. I'm so glad that Brendan did last week's message and not me. It's part two, corruption, talking about sin, and he did an awesome job. If you haven't listened to either of those messages, if you're visiting, go online, listen to those two. They're awesome. And Brendan talked about sin. What is it? Essentially, explaining that sin is image failure. When we fail to live up to the image of God that we are. And the breakdown, the relational breakdown that takes place when we muck up. He looked at what we can do. And one of the things that struck me was that even though we are sinners, we don't stop being the image of God. That never ended. Just because we get it wrong, or Adam and Eve got it wrong. It's a bit like saying, a painting that is trashed is still a painting. If I was to go and throw a bucket of red paint over one of those paintings over there, that painting would still be a painting. It would just look a bit muckier. And when we sin, we're still the image of God. Just a little bit tarnished, but still there. The masterpiece is still there that God made all along. And I get the fun part. I get to talk about Jesus. As we start, some of you will be here and this is new to you, and that's awesome. Some of you will be here and thinking, I've heard the Jesus talk I don't know how many times. You experienced churchgoers, you experienced Jesus hearers. I've been in church all my life, and I'm still not quite at the 30 point yet, and I've heard the Jesus story over and over again. It's the best story there is, but you hear it over and over again. And you... familiarity can, I don't want to say breed contempt, but breed complacency. There is a potential when we think we know the Jesus story, to think, I know it. There's not much left to learn. But I guess if there's anything, if you've heard the Jesus story over and over again, I guess what I'd like to do is a bit like if you were to have a big sculpture that you look at from the same angle, you think you know that sculpture. I guess what I kind of would like to do is just kind of move you that way a little bit. And you might see the same sculpture, but just hear it's something that clicks a little bit differently to what you've known before. We think we know the Jesus story, but I don't know, as an experienced churchgoer, an experienced Jesus hearer, I'm always hearing something slightly different. It gives me a bit more of a complete picture. And on that note, I'm going to tell you about me, because when I talk... when I write, I like details. I'm a details guy. If I have an option, I'll never use 6 words when 12 will do to explain a point. I came out at the life group we did a couple of weeks ago as a closet posh. I like to use the creative language to explain my points. I like to go the long way around, the scenic route. Last night, actually, at worship... I was talking to Andy, and there were some leads sitting on the floor. And usually, if you don't know what to do with the leads, you just say, do you want to clear the leads away, or do these leads need to stay here? It's an unconscious reaction that in my brain that triggered me going out to Andy and say, are these leads superfluous to your requirements? And the smile I got was wonderful. It's just a more creative way to say it. It's more fun. But also, the details to me matter. If I'm telling you a story, I'm telling you the details because they construct the picture better. Now, if I'm talking to my wife, she's different. She's bottom line girl. She wants to know the point. If I'm going to use 12 words, she wants 3. She wants me to get to the point and get there quickly. If I'm explaining the story, she's already at the end while I'm away halfway through, and I want to explain the story, but she wants me to just get straight to the point, get to the bottom line. And save us so much time. It's interesting. Any details people in here? Yeah? Any bottom line people in here? Life is so much shorter when you're bottom line, eh? But it's interesting. We are a blend of the two. But we do, you know, I can sort of do bottom line from time to time if I really have to. I guess the fact that I'm going to be talking for the next few minutes kind of rebuffs that theory. But what happens if we ask, what's the bottom line of Jesus? You know, if we want to summarize Jesus in a word, and I think most of us, if we throughout our lives, have had to do something along these lines. Like, what did Jesus do? What was important about him? And generally, and I've done this myself, if we are asked to give the bottom line to Jesus, it'll be something along the lines of, we talk about his death, and we talk about his resurrection. We talk something along the lines of, his death was Christ taking the punishment for my sin so I could live forgiven and free. His resurrection was him conquering death, proving that death is not the end of the story, so I can live in the hope of eternity with him. Now, both of those points are completely true. And they summarize those parts of his life so, so well. And there is no denying either of that. But if we stop there, it's a bit like being given a beautiful puzzle box, but only reading the writing on the outside. The puzzle box is still there. It's still brilliant. It's still awesome. But I feel like we've kind of almost done him an injustice, because there's still 33 years prior to death and resurrection that he lived on earth, walking, talking, doing life and ministry. And so today, what I'm going to be asking is, what did Jesus' life accomplish? If we emphasize his death and resurrection so much, and rightly so, but what did his life do? What I'm going to try and get through today is that Jesus' life showed what a king really is. That he was it, and he is it. And that we get to follow in that line. To do that, we're going to go back to the book of Isaiah, chapter 9. We're going to read two passages in Isaiah, very well known. And as you hear them, read them, think about this question. What would you want in a king if you were living under oppression, but you were promised a savior, someone to deliver you, a king, someone who would rule and help things out? So Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6 to 7, we read it basically every year at Christmas. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. If you're hearing that account of what a king will be like and you're living under oppression, these are ticking boxes, man. This is yes, 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 Wonderful Counselor, yes, Mighty God, yes, Everlasting, yes. He's going to establish and uphold his kingdom. Yes, king, bring it on. That's what you want in a king, right? But then there's also Isaiah 61. And we're going to read verses 1 to 3, which says, "The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and to provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor." Now, if you're living under oppression, waiting for this promised king, Isaiah 9, yeah, bring it on. Isaiah 61, well, sounds like a nice guy, but generally don't join the two together. But interestingly, when Jesus is alive on earth, it is Isaiah 61 that he quotes as, "I'm fulfilling it." He's fulfilling Isaiah 9 totally. But he takes on Isaiah 61 and speaks, actually, this is fulfilled in your hearing. He speaks to a crowd in Luke chapter 4. He came to be a king, but nothing like what anybody was expecting, least of all Israel. The idea of a king is throughout the Old Testament. A bit of background information. Kings were, you know, from about the book of 1 Samuel onwards, Israel has some sort of a king involved in their lives. And they weren't supposed to have one. God was supposed to be the king. But they wanted one, so God gave them one. They badgered him long enough and nagged and said, "We want a king." Okay, you'll get one. You'll get a few. And you had good kings and you had bad kings. Kings that would do what was right in the eyes of God. Kings that would do what was wrong in the eyes of God. Kings that would lead them closer and further away. Some would be key influences in driving them as far as exile. They were that bad. But good king, bad king, there were three basic characteristics that would summarize what a king had or what a king stood for. Firstly, a king had power. He had all the authority and answered to no one. Second, a king had status. As a king, you were revered and admired by your people. The third, as a king, you were the figurehead. It takes that status issue a bit further. To be a figurehead meant that basically the hopes and aspirations of your nation would rest on your shoulders. Let's just say that Raglan had a king and we were a country of our own. To be the figurehead would be that we would look at Raglan, and our perception of Raglan and how good Raglan was entirely wrapped up in how good we thought our king was. If our king is good, Raglan is good. And if our king is bad, Raglan is bad. And into that presumption of the king being a man of power, a man of status, a figurehead, you have Jesus. And he shows up, and it's this weird, paradoxical nightmare that ensues. If you were Jesus' PR manager, because, you know, everyone who's significant needs a good PR manager, an agent. Jesus is a nightmare. Like, what is it? He's doing all the right things, but in all the wrong ways. Yes, he's a man of power. He spends his life healing people and driving out demons and raising people from the dead. But he's doing all that to all the most unlikely of people. He heals a centurion's servant. And if you're a PR manager, you know, you think to yourself, no, he represents the enemy. You don't heal the enemy. Canaanite woman. Again, enemy. Wake up, Jesus. You're a king sent to deliver our people. And even when he does heal our people, if you're a Jew, he does it so wrong. Remember the account of the healing of the raising of the dead girl? So many faux pas in that story. Jesus, we know him as the high priest. If you're around Bible terminology long enough, a high priest would never go in the same room as a dead body. Jesus goes and picks up her hand. She dead. He unclean. Got the power. He's exercising it. It's a bit weird. He's got status. Wherever he goes, he draws a crowd. Yeah, he can't stop him. Yeah, he'll be going across the lake and people know, oh, he's going across the lake. Let's beat him to it. Let's get there. He's going to say something and do some cool stuff. He's revered and admired, but he seems to hang out so much more with the most unlikely of people, the tax collectors, the sinners, the social outcasts. How can you expect to start a revolution on the back of that? If you want to start a revolution, you know, establishing what a king should be, you need the movers and shakers of society. They're the ones who get you attention. Not the misfits, the oddballs, the cast asides. And he was a figurehead. You know, the hopes and dreams of so many people were put on Jesus. And they looked at him and thought, Savior. But what kind of king would allow himself to be abused, to be mocked, ridiculed, falsely tried, beaten, assaulted, and eventually executed. Doing it all right, but all wrong. Some king, huh? Except there's obviously more at play than our conventional, this is what a king should do, this is how a king should act, perceptions. To illustrate that, we're going to look at John chapter 4. It's one of my most favorite, examples of Jesus showing this is what a king does. This is how a king should act. It's the account of Jesus talking to the Samaritan woman. And we're going to read from verse 4. Now he, Jesus, had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar. Debates abound for that one. Near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. Key point, it was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into the town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew," key point, Jew, "and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, key word, "sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock?" Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming back here to draw water." He told her, "Go, call your husband and come back." "I have no husband," she replied. Jesus said to her, "You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is that you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true." "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet." Key word, prophet. "Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, the time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming, and has now come, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and the worshippers and his worshippers must worship in the spirit and in truth." The woman said, "I know that Messiah," key word, Messiah, "called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." And then Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, I am he." I love it. It's a classic case of king meets classic undesirable. There are lots of reasons why, again, this is an account that breaks all the social faux pas, tears them apart. But I mentioned right at the beginning, keyword, it was about, well, key phrase, it was about noon. This is important to the story because she was coming out to draw water. And culturally in those days, women would draw water either early in the morning or late at night. Never during the middle of the day, right in the heat of the day. Now, why would she be drawing water at the heat of the day? She comes to the well, and we learn later on that she's got a shady past. She's been married five times. We suspect probably that she's not widowed five times either. And the man she's living with is not her husband. She's living in sin, according to the Jewish law. She doesn't want to be seen. She wants to be anonymous. So she goes to draw water in the middle of the day. And we're not even really going to focus too much on what Jesus says to her, but rather what she starts saying to him. Well, Jesus starts on common ground. "I'm thirsty. You're bringing the water. Can I have a drink?" And then she says she addresses him four different ways. First one, Jew. Now, I don't know if how much you read the Bible out loud, but has anyone ever noticed that when we read the Bible out loud, we're generally reasonably monotone, and we don't give our characters a lot of character. Thankfully, I'm a dad to some 5-year or 4-year old and a 1-year old, and I study drama at school, so I love giving characters character. Not only is it important to read what is said, but also how it would be said. When she's saying, you are a Jew, she's not saying, you're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan. It's much worse than that. The cultural, the opposition that Jews and Samaritans face with each other meant that she was rather saying, you are a Jew. I'm a Samaritan. We don't hang out. It's rough. It's raw. It's tense. It's not a good conversation starter. But Jesus starts talking to her regardless, breaking the gender faux pas that Jews don't hang out with women, that certainly not their wives. You don't hang out with an individual woman back in those days. He starts talking to her. The second thing she says is, sir. There's a little bit of respect there. Just something's just shifted a little bit. As she's talking to Jesus, says, sir, goes from Jew to sir. Thirdly, prophet. Jesus reveals what he knows, already knows about her. She hasn't told him. He said, I can see you are a prophet. Now, a prophet is a position of honor. This is more than just respect. You're something. That's what she's saying. But at the end, she goes one step further and says, Messiah, are you it? From Jew to sir to prophet to Messiah in one conversation with the king. I didn't read verse 29. What happens is the disciples come back and they're pretty shocked. You know, what's he doing hanging out with her? They don't say anything, but you can see the surprise in their faces. He ain't meant to be doing that. The woman leaves her jar of water. She goes back to her town. And she says, come, see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? What results in the next few verses? She becomes the most influential, we will say evangelist, but we've always got a bit of a negative view of evangelist when we think tele-evangelism. But no, she reaches her entire town and brings them to Jesus. She went from, I really want to be anonymous. I don't want anyone to see me. I'm a mess. To, I've got to reach my community. They need to know Jesus. All it took was one conversation. This is how a king was always supposed to act. We can call it revolutionary, but in a way it's really not. In John 14, verse 9, this is kind of an aside, but it's an important aside. John 14:9, Jesus says, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. What Jesus is doing in John 4 with a Samaritan woman is what God has been doing throughout the Old Testament. He's been saying this the whole time. And you ever find yourself kind of playing God versus Jesus? You know, we like Jesus. He's nice. God, he can be a bit rough. You know, he's pretty crazy sometimes. But actually, he's saying, Jesus is saying, I am what God has been saying this whole time. We are a perfect match. Anyone who's seen me has seen him. If you want to know what God is like in the Old Testament, look at me. I'm everything that he was trying to say. I'm the king that you really needed. You got the king you wanted. And look at you, you wound up a mess. I'm the king you always needed. He spends his life being the image of God that we've been hearing a few times in the last couple of weeks. The king that we were always meant to have. He is what God has been saying this whole time. So what about us? You know, it's great. Jesus' life accomplished, the displaying of what a king was really meant to be all about. What does it mean for us? I don't know about you. Has anyone, you don't have to put your hands up, but I'm sure everyone's had that woman of the well kind of experience where you just want to go anonymous. Yeah, I'm a mess. I don't want to be seen. People know me. I grew up a pastor's kid in the UK, and there are a lot of advantages of being a pastor's kid. Two wonderful parents, both totally in love with God, still are today, and they're still on fire for Him. The downsides of being a pastor's kid is that you live with this huge expectation that, when people look at you, they look at someone and they think, he's the good kid. He'll do well. But it's a mocking expectation. You grow up in an English public school, and they are looking at you thinking, "Here's the good kid. That we're waiting for him to muck up. We're waiting for one small slip up, and the cards come toppling down." Well, it's not fun. That weight of expectation of managing. Okay, this is people are looking at me, and I've got to keep up that image. And you want to. Oh, you want to. But my other problem as a kid growing up was I'm a bit like Curious George the monkey. Yeah, I really appreciated how my parents protected me, in a lot of ways. But I was kind of like, what's it like being them? Like, what's it like not being under that weight of expectation? And I had no big crisis of faith moment. I had no massive go off the rails and massive testimony of, going crazy and then having to come back and or anything like that. But I would be what you'd call probably a teenage dabbler. Really curious, and sometimes just no. But it was much worse than that because I felt the weight of expectation. If I even slipped up just a little bit, that failure cut so deep. And I'd feel like a huge stuff up, that I would let God down. And that was my woman at the well moment, like, why would you want to notice God? Why would you want to notice me? Why, at best, can you just fix me? At best, can you fix me? What I've been learning as we've been studying is actually God, as much as he can, he's not really that interested in fixing. He's more interested in transforming. And there's a big difference. One of the major themes that's been coming through this mini-series is that the image of God keeps coming up. Yeah, Marion explained that we are made in his image. Brendan explained that when we sin, we are failing in his image. But through Jesus, we get to step into that image. In a way that Adam and Eve never could. You ever find yourself like longing for the good old days? You're looking back saying, oh, I'm not as strong as I used to be, handsome as I used to be, smart as I used to be, kind as I used to be. You're always looking back at how I used to be. And sometimes as Christians, you take that further. I wish I could go back to Adam and Eve in the garden where everything was good and rosy and great. Jesus and his life shows that in his humanity, he was the image of God that Adam and Eve were supposed to become. We're not here to look back at the good old days. We're here to look forward at who we're becoming. The good old days, no. When we come to Jesus, we're not coming to God as just a fix-up project. We're here to be renewed, transformed, made a new creation. The way N.T. Wright puts it, when someone comes to Jesus and engages in relationship with him, you become a shadow of your future self. Now we say that shadow of your former self a lot. Yo, look at him. He's a shadow of his former self. No. The woman at the well is a shadow of her future self from when she showed up to when she left. As we engage in relationship with Jesus, we are just shadows of our future self, where what we are today is not a jot on who we will be in 1 week, 2 months, 3 years, decades from now, until Jesus returns. We are the image of God, made in his likeness, and being progressively more and more and more honed in, perfected even, until we are the image that God always designed us to be. We're not supposed to look back at Adam and Eve in the good old days. We're supposed to look at Christ and look forward. That's supposed to get us excited, because we are not who we're going to be. We're not who we once were, but we're not anywhere near close to who we're going to be. That is exciting. And the world needs that from us. The woman at the well is transformed in a conversation to who she never thought she could be. And she leads her entire town to Jesus. I encourage you to read the whole thing. Read the whole of John chapter 4. It's brilliant. Raglan, wherever you're from, your town needs that from you. That message, you have the opportunity to communicate that you're not just fix-ups, that God's just mended. You know, it's still quite, you know, the thing is with fix-ups is they're still second-hand, so they're always going to break later on. No, no, no. You're not fix-ups. You're new. You're transformed. You are a shadow of your future self. And the world needs to see that. You are the image of God, and you're becoming more and more the image of God. It's a reason to get excited. It's a reason for joy. It's a reason to approach life completely differently to the tarnished image that we heard about last week, to even the original image that we heard about the week before. So I think we're going to get ready to worship and have a bit of time of response. And I don't know where we've come from, what baggage we carry. Everyone carries baggage into church. It's just part of us being us. But we are called to step in and follow that line. Jesus really is King, and we're called to follow in his footsteps. We are the image of God, becoming more and more like it every day. Shadows of our future selves. So respond as you need to, whatever Holy Spirit's been saying. I'm going to pray, and then we'll have some time to worship. God, thank you for Jesus. Thank you for our Savior who lived and died and rose again, all for us. He showed us what it is to be a king. You were the king that we always needed. It should have always been you. And thank you that it is right now. You are a king, and the kingdom of heaven is here. And we live in that collision of heaven and earth, becoming more and more and more like the image we were always meant to reflect. Father, I pray for the messages that have been coming through the last couple of weeks. And also this one as we come to the end of this series. And I pray that we would step on and step forward into a fuller understanding of who we are and whose we are and who you are. I pray that we would not be content to just look behind at what we could have been, but look forward with excitement about who we're becoming. And I pray that as we live out of that joy and that excitement, the world would watch and change. It would be like that Samaritan woman. One conversation with you is all it takes. And we'll go and we'll change the world.